They don't feel at home in the parks. They don't know that it's a part of their legacy, right? They have given that over to whatever other power there is. And so we want to get in here and kind of fight for our young people, but we don't want our young people to have to fight. And so all of that just came up for me as just kind of mentioning it. But it's a sad reality. There's still places for us, and there's still places for them.
Welcome to Jazz Therapy, where we explore the intersectionality of jazz, the psyche and psychoanalytic thought, spirituality, and consciousness. We have in-depth conversations with people from various walks of life, all of whom view their work as a service to humanity. Then we listen to jazz and discuss our thoughts, feelings, and reflections, which arise from hearing this incredible art form. I'm your host, Jesse Shapiro. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. If you or someone you know is feeling suicidal or in an emotional crisis, you can call or text the SAMHSA Crisis Line, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Association, through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Simply call or dial 988 24/7, 365 days a year. My guest today is Reverend Dr. Ambrose F. Carroll, Sr. is the founder and CEO of Green the Church, which is the largest repository and catalyst for the environmental and sustainability movement built for and by the Black Church. Pastor Carroll serves on the National Environmental Justice Action Committee for the United States Environmental Protection Agency. He is president at large of the California State Baptist Convention, and he is a senior fellow with the Atlantic Fellows for Racial Equity. Dr. Carroll sits on the steering committee for the West Oakland Community Action Plan and is a member of the Environmental Justice Committee for the California Air Resources Board. Dr. Carroll earned a BA in psychology from Florida Memorial University in Miami, Florida, a Master of Divinity from Morehouse School of Religion in Atlanta, Georgia, a Master of Business Administration from Golden Gate University in San Francisco, California, and a Doctorate of Divinity from United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio. Reverend Carroll is married to the former Mrs. Catresa Williams, and they have three children. Dr. Carroll, thank you so much for being here with me today. I am just truly honored for you to take time to be here with us today.
Thank you, Jesse. I'm honored to be with you, just inspired by your work and about this time together.
Well, I was thinking about the theme of today, that it would really be spirituality and activism, because you're a spiritual leader, a religious leader, and you're also an activist. And I really love that combination. And just to kind of set the tone for today, I wanted to read a quote about nature. Earth, upon which this moving, breathing life exists, may she bestow on us the finest of her harvests. Earth, the all-sustaining, treasure-bearing resting place, golden-breasted earth, home of all life, who bears the sacred fire. Pleasant be your hills, O earth, your snow-clad mountains and your forests. I stand upon this earth, unvanquished, unslain, unhurt. Set me, O earth, amidst the nourishing strength that emanates from your body. The earth is my mother. I am her son or daughter. Infinite space is my father. May he fill us with plenty. Peaceful, sweet-smelling, gracious earth. Whatever I dig from you, O earth, may that have quick growth again. May we not injure your vitals or your heart. Full of sweetness are the plants, and full of sweetness these my words. And with things that are full of sweetness, I prosper in a thousand ways. Atharva Veda, Earth Invocation from the Vedic Scriptures of Hinduism. Well, Dr. Carroll, your father was Reverend Benjamin Carroll Sr., and your mom and five siblings founded Carroll Ministries International. And you also talked about the fact that your family comes from a 100-year-old homestead in Louisiana. Three of your brothers and your sister became pastors, and so preaching is really deep in your lineage. And I wonder if you could talk about what it was like to grow up having your father be a pastor.
Wow. Those were good years. It was many things. Growing up in the early 70s, I think, with a lot of disparity around Black men, a lot of Black exploitation movies, right? You got a lot of The Mac and a lot of just these gangster shows. Growing up as the son of a pastor had us in a world that you didn't necessarily see on television all the time. So my dad was my hero. I was always, you know, proud of him. The home that he created was always a space for everybody. Like there were young men and women in the community that came and ate with us after church at home. Even though there were six of us, he still adopted a young man. And I don't know if that's because he was clergy, but more so just because of where he was from, just, you know, from down south with a lot of hospitality and a lot of love for others. I think some of those qualities are in my uncles and aunts as well, who are not clergy.
I can really understand that. I also sense that being on the land was probably a big influence on your decision that led you to eventually start Green the Church. And I want to ask you about that later. I am really curious about when you received the calling yourself to become a pastor, just being born into a family with such a rich history.
Yeah, sometimes when I reflect on my calling in the ministry, I say, well, it's one part calling and the other part, it's the family business, you know. But my dad died in 83. I was like 14. And I remember my older brother started preaching maybe 2 years later. Because when something traumatic like that happens, everybody kind of vows to pick up the work, right, and continue on. But when my older brother started preaching, I was like, okay, well, that's good. Somebody's doing it. I can go do something else. And I was in undergrad planning a career in law. And I was actually working with the engineer, just helping the campus facilities. And that summer, all summer long, I just kept hearing kind of a voice saying, if you preach, like that was almost audible. It was, and every answer to every question in every class, I remember being in a sociology class and we're talking about people groups and, you know, how communities make and strive. And the answer to all the questions seemed to be, if you preach. And then I was in Spanish class and somehow came out, if you preach. And I thought that was wild. So I said, this is something. And then a few weeks later, I actually stayed so I could earn some money for the fall, I guess, or something. And then everything that I earned, I bought a plane ticket and went home the next week because I got to the point where I couldn't sleep and I couldn't eat. And I got on a plane and came home to tell my pastor, Reverend Dennis Meredith of the Mount Calvary Church in Oakland, who had followed my dad as lead minister. I told him that I was feeling a call to the ministry. Yeah. And he said, oh, well, that's a divine unction. And he said, well, he said, some people, you know, in ministry in the Bible received a call. He talked about Amos, and Amos was called to go and deliver a message to the king. He was a farmer. And he said, after he delivered his message, he went back to farming. He said, so maybe there's a message that you have to get out. And, you know, and once you do it, if you want to do something else, that's fine, too. And so, yeah, that was my calling into the gospel ministry.
Well, it sounds like at first it was so intense, the calling, that it really shook you up and you were distressed by it. You said you couldn't eat and sleep.
Yeah.
It was intense.
And, you know, often in ministry, you long for those moments of assurance. You know, after I was able to come and say, you know, this is what I feel led to do, our pastor said, well, when you come back for Christmas, you can preach your first sermon. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, because I stutter, I said, oh, I can't really preach. He said, yeah, now what am I going to do? And so then I, you know, studied and all those things and delivered. But since that moment of yielding, you know, you long for that kind of, to be in that place of surrender where your calling, where your path is so assured. The old folks say, well, I know that I know that I know. Right. So what are you doing and why? So I think it is those things that hold us even in the midst of difficult times. So we grew up in a, you know, community. You talk about two things. First, your conversion experience as a Christian, like what happened to you? When did you know that you had been converted, that you had been what the old folks call born again? And then there is the narrative of the call. So I think these things just being a part of tradition and part of highlights that we would think we would see along the way kind of open us up to that. So that's my experience.
I really love what you said about yielding and surrender, just that it was very strong message that God was giving you. And I think you're kind of juxtaposing that of other moments of uncertainty that we all go through in life. I know oftentimes I will be praying for something and I'll sit in meditation and I'll have a decision to make. And I'll say like, God, just tell me what to do. Right. I'm right here. And there'll be kind of like this grasping for it. And of course the answer or whatever it is, it doesn't ever come when I am in that state. It will come kind of gradually. Sometimes there is a lot of uncertainty. Right. And I hear you saying the call to ministry was very strong. And that there's maybe been other times when you had that to keep you going and the message wasn't as strong, since we don't get that all the time.
Yes, precisely. A lot of things and unctions and you're like, okay, where am I at? What am I doing? You know, what do I believe? Right? All of those pieces. But again, you're catapulted back to that place. And I guess that's why those moments like Moses at the burning bush. Right. You see him in that place of certainty. But then you also see him striking the rock. You see him in his places of frustration.
I agree. I think uncertainty is the hardest thing for us as human beings to bear. I always tell that to my clients in my psychotherapy practice. What do you personally do when you struggle with moments of uncertainty, just psychologically, spiritually? I talked about my grasping, you know, in prayer. How do you handle that?
I go to sleep. Sleep is a cure-all. I think in those times of uncertainty, you lean on what you know, right? And you lean on the experiences of your past. David, who had to face Goliath of Gath, and in the Bible, as he's facing Goliath of Gath, he starts rambling off his history of being in battle. He says, well, there was once a wolf, right, that attacked my flock. I know how I was going to get out of that, but I prayed to God. And then God gave me wisdom and whatever. Then there was a bear. And one time I had to deal with a bear. And oh, yeah. So he goes into his faith folder, right? And so then when you're in times of uncertainty, I'm looking at this giant, how am I going to make it? Well, I didn't know how I was going to make it some other times, but what is divine, came into a place to hold me, to shield me, to buffer me up. And so I think in times of uncertainty, I try to reach back in my faith folder. I try to remember, being a son of a single mother in East Oakland and in some very tough times in the history of this country, and understanding friends and acquaintances that, you know, some who've done very well, some who have been in prison for long amounts of time, some whose funerals we attended, and some whose funeral we officiated. But then thinking about the grace of God and thinking about the God of our fathers and grandparents that shouldered us up. And so in the time of uncertainty, yeah, you remembered how God bought you.
That's lovely, the idea of a faith folder. I've heard of people having in their emails a folder where they have emails that people sent them when they were expressing a lot of gratitude, or and that people would go back to that in times, you know, to bolster them. And I think I hear you saying at a deeper level that thinking about your lineage and, you know, what we have in the Bible, that those messages of resilience give you strength in times of uncertainty to continue forward.
And even, you know, continuing forward is good, but sometimes it's just how to be, you know, like even the pain of loss and mourning. Sometimes we try to get past our mourning and our loss. But the real question is how to be in the midst of mourning and loss, right? How to hold things in the moment and not to, you know, kind of run away from it so fast, and to be empowered by those experiences.
If you'd like to know more, you can visit my website at www.jazztherapy.com. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in the states of California and New York. You can also check out my profile page on Psychology Today, which I'll leave linked below. Well, that's it right there, is what you just said, just being present with whatever circumstance we're in and whatever emotion. And it sounds so simple and so easy, and yet being present can be like just the biggest cross to bear for all of us humans, just tolerating some of the most painful feelings, the feelings we want to escape. Just I read that in 2009 you read The Green Collar Economy by New York Times bestselling author Van Jones, and he's an environmentalist. And you said, quote, "When I read his book, I felt like someone had articulated for our generation what would be our big tent issue, the way our foreparents had the civil rights movement." And you talked about how you resonated with his holistic standpoint that was, quote, "racially diverse and including serving the needs of those who are poor, such as feeding and clothing people," and how he expanded environmentalism to people of color. I wonder if you could tell us about that moment and how that led to the founding of Green the Church.
Yeah, I think it was an awesome moment. And, you know, everything is around timing, right? And I was coming out of a church in Colorado at the time. And I wasn't the only one to read it, obviously, because I ended up in the Green for All Fellowship. I became a Green for All Fellow like months after reading the book and then getting online and saying, oh, there has to be something going on with this right now. And they were doing something with a hip hop caucus called Green the Block. And I found people in Colorado who were participating in this Green the Block thing and connected. And when I became a fellow, there were people who had read that book who were print artists or graphic artists, music artists, rappers. There were individuals who were working for big green organizations. But it was amazing because everybody was vibing off of this book, and they were putting stuff from in this book in rap. Like, they were putting it in forms that were culturally appropriate so that they could communicate it to people in their communities. I was like, wow, like, this is a moment in time. Like, there were people from coal mining communities, right, in West Virginia and stuff like that, trying to figure out how to like talk about this in coal mine territory, where the threat of losing coal mining jobs kind of goes along with this, and how are they communicating this to their parents or people who are union bosses. But seeing people use different genres, right? Different idioms in order to express that was just like, wow. And so as an African American clergy, I was like, oh, we can preach this, right? We have to preach this. We have to share this in, like, if you're doing this in hip hop, right? And right after I became a fellow, of course, Obama goes into the White House, and then Van Jones for a short time is the green job czar. So when I get to the fellowship, Van Jones is greeting us via probably from Skype, right? From the White House, right? Like all this
Wow.
technology is moving right at the same time. It's like he's talking to us from the White House. Like this thing is hot. Like this is important. And so I was blessed to be a part of that for that time, and really feeling like it was important work to be done.
It sounds like it was a real synchronicity of, I mean, in the culture and for you personally, of that the world was really ready for this, and especially taking the message of environmentalism and moving it from just what scientists are saying is, you know, I've read you've talked about, to also communities that really are most impacted by the degradation of the climate. In my research for today, I read a 2020 article from Inside Climate News, and it was about how Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock was running for Senate and how his church in Atlanta is also participating in Green the Church. And in the article, you were quoted about how part of the mission of Green the Church is to connect with an African spirituality. And you said, quote, "In African theological concepts, there is no dichotomy between the sacred and the secular. Everything is sacred. At the deepest level, I hear that meaning everything is God." And I wonder if you could tell us more about this and how that really guides Green the Church and the work that you're doing.
Wow, yeah, thank you for the question. So when we started, we had three pillars. The first one is amplifying green liberation theology, then it's promoting sustainable practices, and finally it's building powerful political and economic change. And when we started in 2010, I didn't know how much talking about theology from an environmental lens would actually shape the scope of my personal God talk. I'm educated at Morehouse School of Religion, the Interdenominational Theological Center, that has always been a relatively progressive theological place of instruction. But I moved even from the notion of being Afrocentric. Our values are around, sometimes I call it race, sometimes I call it care. But it's resilience, Afrocentricity, courage, and empowerment. In recent years, even the notion of Afrocentricity, we changed from Afrocentricity to aboriginality, right? What it means to be aboriginal. So really, as I talk about what is divine, being African American, and again, I'm an ordained Baptist clergy. And also, I often tell people when I'm in like interfaith, connections, because a lot of, my friends may be Buddhist, and they're Asian, or they may be Muslim and they're Arabic, and they may be Baptist and they may be German, right? So evidently, there's a break in terms of what it means to have a people group surrounded by God talk, right? That is passed down from generation to generation. But if my spiritual conversation and language only stems from what my people learned four generations ago, when my people, right, have been people groups for the last 6,000 years, then there's something missing. And so we really began to talk about spirituality. Understanding what it means to be Christian from its essence, right? Really beginning to understand the birth of Christianity in and of itself, understanding that there are Christian concepts that are a lot more ancient than anything in the Old Testament itself. So really beginning to learn more about African spirituality, but also embracing and learning more about Native American spirituality, Indian spirit, like all of these Eastern notions, that when you begin to study, a lot of them have the same birthplace. So we begin to open up for those conversations because those conversations allow us to start having real spiritual conversations with indigenous people all over the world. And the reality is that all people stem from indigenous land-based practices. And that I think that when we talk about, I often say, you know, you can be, you can do this work without becoming an environmentalist. Because as people of faith, people from Black church perspective, environmentalism is not our catchword, but our catchword is that of revival. Black church, no matter if you're Methodist or AME or Church of God in Christ, you're going to have some revival. You believe anything old, decrepit, decayed can be made brand new again. And so we talk about revival. We talk about having a great remembrance. We talk about restoration, right? All of these pieces, right, that we're able to restore relationships in the human family. And so we're trying to find those common denominators that bring us together. Because ultimately, what Green the Church is formed to do is to help, you know, bring forth the beloved community on this planet.
That's so all-encompassing and so beautiful. I was reading about the concept of revivalism, and you said stewardship itself is an environmental message because what we are talking about is being responsible for the things of God and not turning that responsibility over to an oppressive majority culture. We should do ministry as we always have done and take time to draw a line from that work to the ministry of stewardship of the land and of one another.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the issue of responsibility for a lot of communities, we just live in such a place where we used to know where things were. We knew our relationship with God, even our relationship with the land, our relationship with animals, with things that we consume. And we've been in a place where we're so far away from it. We click a switch and lights come on. We don't really know what the process entails, right? We turn on a faucet and water runs. But we don't like know our waterways, right? And I think those things take us away from having the kind of respect and awe and appreciation of Mother Nature. The poem that you read, right, that talks about the sweet earth, that talks about, you know, how we dig and take things out of her. And with knowledge, right, and saying that wherever we take it from, that it doesn't hurt the process of regeneration, right? And we take it as a blessing. But then what's our responsibility to steward? And a lot of people coming up on the, Turtle Island or the West, we often talk about it as if it was some barren place, some unmanaged place. But the reality is that the people were responsible, who helped to bend the stream, right? Who purposefully brought forth fire at a certain time of year, so that it would be ready and it would be a certain way the next time. So what we see is just awesome beauty is really manicured. It's really the people had taken responsibility in this garden. And I think that we're so far away from that. A lot of us are finding purpose because a lot of people walking around, our purpose is to steward the land but we haven't even seen the land. So then we live lives like very frustrated because we are gifted to do some things that we have not been introduced to.
I hear you talking about our lack of connection with the earth, and that there's been a movement, especially with the rise of capitalism and, of just a profit-driven society, that there's really now like a subjugation of nature for man's own profit and gain at the expense, especially of communities of color and those who are impoverished. In doing my research, I was reading about in an Everyday Health article that would came out about you. A 2017 NAACP report found that, quote, more than 1 million African Americans live within half a mile of existing natural gas facilities, and the number is growing every year. And also that in West and downtown Oakland, where more than 70% of the population are people of color, up to 1 in 2 new childhood cases of asthma were due to traffic-related pollution. And this is by contrast in the Oakland Hills, which we all know is a much wealthier area. 1 in every 5 cases of childhood asthma are caused by traffic pollution. And this was also impacted, as I learned, by President Eisenhower signing the 1956 Federal Aid Highway Act, which displaced Black communities and created roads through Black communities. So this really stems from a long, long time ago. And it is something that really needs to be addressed because this is just unacceptable.
Ooh, Jesse, you did your homework, let me tell you. That's spot on. I mean, again, a lot of times we live in a country that, that the facade is this rugged individualism, right? Pulling oneself up by one's own bootstraps. It really is a facade because we live in a nation that purposefully, decided who it would support. And again, if left to its own devices, before World War II, right? Like you had communities. When we talk about marginalized communities, it's always been the African American population, but it's usually African Americans and, right? So before World War II, the African Americans and the Italians and the Polish and the Jews, we were all together, right? But I think, when you look at what happened at Stanford with men like President Hoover and those who saw socialism rise in Europe, where you saw human beings, so pushed down that they began to revolt. In America, they decided that they had to release the pressure cooker. So they knew that they had to have some form of socialism, some form of involvement of the people. And I think, things like the New Deal and housing really allowed that to happen so that everybody was not just a part of this total underclass, and they prepared housing and schools and all of those things. The problem is they decided to leave a permanent underclass in Black people so that our friends and relatives, right, who were able to get housing in Concord and Newark, right, who used to live in West Oakland and Berkeley and Vallejo, some were able to leave out. But then some were very purposefully redlined into places that, again, nationally, communities were destroyed, freeways were places of demarcation, Highway 13. And we even talk about our communities in a way that most people don't. We talk about, Black communities and ghettos as places that you're working to get out of, right? Which is totally like, this is home and we really don't want to be here. We want to be somewhere else. And so, yeah, all of those things very detrimental, not only to the body. And again, this is the clumsiness of our nation and trying to separate by color and distinction, because even now I live in West Oakland and I'm one of the few African Americans on the block. But West Oakland still has pollution, trains, planes, and automobiles, right? It's all happening right here. And we're still trying to find a way to make sure that we are at least spreading the pollution out so that one place doesn't bear it all. So even in a gentrified Oakland where now these homes are becoming expensive, we're still battling the same battle of how do we have clean air and clean water in these spaces and places. And for us, because gentrification is so real, we're trying to make sure that the places where African Americans are moving are not redesigned to be places that are unhealthy. So, I think it's, and then Green the Church wants to be a part. We're fighting no coal in Oakland. We're having conversations about the Oakland airport expansion. You know, how do we do things? How do we bring the issue of ethics into every conversation? Because in the city of God, yes, there has to be an economic arm. Yes, there has to be a political arm. But if there is no ethical arm to hold us in balance, then we will be unhealthy. So we stand to take responsibility, regardless of your faith tradition, what it means to be ethical.
That has to be absolutely paramount. I read that you said Christ was not motivated to be above others or dominant, but with others and part of the whole in terms of the work of making sure there's equity for everybody.
Yes, most definitely. Most definitely. I was with the fellow Brian K. Woodson, and we were talking about God and divinity, and we started talking about supremacy, and we often look at, Christ as supreme. And he looked at me and he said, I don't even know if God wants to be supreme. I was like, what? And he started talking. He said, right, Christ came, Emmanuel, to be with us, not to lord over us. Because what happens in the lineup of supremacy, then we line up under, right? So if Christ is supreme, and then if I'm a white male, I'm right under Christ. If you're a white woman, you're under me. If you're a black man, you're under her somewhere. If you're a black woman, you're under. And then so we line up, right, in this supremacist kind of formality, and we sign God's name to it. And I thought that was fascinating to hear as I sat eating in Berkeley, and he challenged this notion of Christ and supremacy.
I really agree with that, that he would want us to be for everybody, that if not everyone wins and nobody wins is, I think, really the deep premise that you're getting at. And that is truly the message of unconditional love, that when we are acting from that place, that naturally is birthed, because we cannot do but that, but act in love.
Yeah. Amen.
Well, one recent project that you worked on was with Gemini Energy Solutions and the Bay Area Church Glad Tidings to construct and work with fiscal agents to finance a $7 million revenue generating microgrid at the church. And this is really at the cutting edge of environmentalism in urban environments. And I wonder if you could tell us more about this.
Yeah, sure. And I just read yesterday President Biden is planning to do some more things to really beef up our ability to move forward with EV charging in the country. Pollution. And again, you talk about my son suffers from asthma, living right here in West Oakland. And when you are driving electric vehicles by, it's better for his ability to breathe, right? Than driving things that are, bringing forth toxins into the ether. In fact, after this call going up to Glad Tidings, we're just about ready to kind of close things out. We are doing solar, electric vehicle charging, and battery at Glad Tidings. So they'll be one of our first microgrids. And not only are they a energy grid and a microgrid. They are a resilience hub. They, you know, plan to grow food on church-owned land. They've also, the new building where solar will be on top of this brand new roof, will also house a gymnasium for the youth, but also will have a technology lab where, you know, they can come in and talk about biotechnology. They're talking about AI. We're trying to make sure that this issue of STEM is really apparent so that we understand as we move forward that how mathematics and engineering and art, all of those things really come together to help the next generation to thrive. But we want to be a part of the solution, and we want our young people to know that we expect God to breathe through them to bring forth solutions as we take responsibility for the possibility of sea level rise in the Bay Area, that we look with clear lenses into what the possible fallout is that comes from climate change and begin to work to steward the land, to be who God and what the divine has called us to be. And I'm really proud of Bishop Jerry Macklin and the leadership of the Glad Tidings Church as they have, you know, really stepped up. Their church, like a lot of African-American churches, are right off of the expressway where a lot of traffic passes through. Also in industrial areas where there are, you know, some companies that are changing their fleets out from gas fired vehicles to electric vehicles. So we're working with the city and trying to work with those institutions so that those institutions charge their cars at Glad Tidings Church. And they're able to generate power. They will have bi-directional EV charging so that in the time of storm or fire or anytime power goes out, that that you can drive up electric cars to the church, plug them in, and power the church so that people will have a safe harbor in times of distress. At present, we are actually writing a grant that's from the Department of Energy and the EPA for $20 million. And if we get it, it will allow us to do at least 10 others churches right here in the Bay Area to take them through that same process and to empower them and to allow them to generate revenue, which also allows them to hire more African-American contractors and electricians and other ancillary businesses. We want to see young people doing workforce development, learning how to install solar and become electricians and work on a lot of the technology that's coming forward. So we're excited about that work and excited about the potential to empower community and to bring us into industry.
So it's not only just passing on the values of stewardship and promoting sustainability, it's also then continuing to impart growth and thriving in terms of the Black community and also helping the environment at the same Indeed. Time. That's really awesome. I really hope that grant goes Thank through. You. I also read that as part of greening the Black church, you're working in helping establish food systems and farms in areas which are currently considered food deserts. And you recently partnered with Reverend Mikhail Smith of McGee Baptist Church in Berkeley, who founded the Center for Food, Faith, yeah. and Justice. And Reverend Smith really pointed out in the reading that I did about how pesticides are one of the biggest pollutants on the planet and how this is absolutely, of course, linked to environmentalism. And this movement involves creating and growing food and gardens on the property of Black churches and involving the community in this work. And you said there is healing power in the soil. There is something that God gives you in planting a seed that's regenerative and life-giving. Tell us more about this and the impact that you see this is having.
Yeah, so for us, everything is pretty holistic. And we talked a little bit about my dad and just growing up in Louisiana. And one thing, you know, we grew up, my dad pastored in St. Louis, Missouri. We lived in Compton, California, Linwood, Santa Ana, and then Oakland. So we're pretty much city dwellers. But every year we go home. And I often said my granddad in the 1970s, although there were oil wells all around his homestead, they didn't have running water in the house, right? And everything was around that well. You had to go get that well water to cook. You had to go get that well water to take a bath. But the well water was good. It was fresh. And the food that they grew, the produce, the corn, the peas. We didn't have a lot of protein, right? We didn't eat a lot of steak. But very healthy foodstuffs. And so I often say people talk about food deserts. Our grandparents would roll over in their graves if they said that we couldn't have any collard greens because the store closed. They wouldn't understand that, right? So our ability to reach back into epigenetics of our DNA, right? The molecular structure of our DNA, and know that we know how to put seed in the ground. And as a part of our stewardship, that we just believe every church ought to be growing food. Our young people ought to be very familiar with how food is produced, and we have to know how to feed ourselves. So, you know, we're talking about urban gardening, but also about farming and about farming in ways that are not like industrial farming, right? Who just finished his doctoral dissertation. He calls it Black Soil Theology. He talks about agro farming. He talks about, you know, farming in a way that gives best benefit to the soil so that you can farm again. And so these notions, so right now we're trying to make sure they just received a grant of about $300,000 here locally. And we're going to make sure that we can, with our same churches and congregations, go in and give them some help and some support on growing food. But also doing classes about backyard gardens and teaching people how to grow food. Pastor Smith and his team, they were teaching people all over the country how to grow food in their house. Again, just a fascinating piece that, of course, has a lot of biblical, you know, undergirth and then those pieces that, again, just brings us back to the land. And for us, having a lot of ceremony around what it means to be in relationship with the land is necessary and needed because we've experienced a lot of trauma when it comes to what it means to serve the land. And so then you get a lot of confusion. But we want to do a lot of work in this area. In fact, on April 20th at 9 in the morning till noon, we're going to be at Pastor Smith's church, the McGee Avenue Baptist Church in Berkeley, having our second climate revival. And we're going to actually have some panelists on that morning, some chefs. We have individuals from Ghana who will be there, a young man working on his PhD out of Ghana. We're going to have some church pastors and laity that run food banks. Pastor Dante Quick is coming in from New Jersey to speak. He's doing one of our microgrids in New Jersey. And we're inviting out the entire community to be a part of what we call Climate Revival.
That sounds like a wonderful event, and I encourage people to go to it and find a way to get involved and support this. In an article about you in Everyday Health, you know, you point out that nature is associated with trauma and many Black Americans don't feel safe in it due to the inhumanity of slaves working in the field and post-slavery violence like lynchings. And you mentioned in this article that you took a group of Black children camping at a Cub Scout retreat in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and an employee saw you and the kids and threatened to call the police and told you that you could not eat there. And the Cub Scout Center subsequently apologized and gave you a full refund. And yet this event had to be very difficult to endure. And it's also disturbing that this occurred in San Francisco, which is supposed to be one of the most liberal cities in the country. I'm just curious, what do you do psychologically and spiritually, internally, to just get through a situation like that, especially also while the children are there with you too?
You know, I think those are the difficult pieces. And we had a good time that week. And, you know, what was happening is one of those things that you really just have to pinch yourself because you're like, no, this really can't be happening like this. Because again, you want to protect your You want to protect the babies. Like, you don't want them to have those kind of experiences. And even though we kind of become used to it or expect it, I think the word, I'm just sad in my body. And it's still sad because, not because they weren't apologetic and all those things. I think in this nation, there's an expectation that the only way to be okay, to be empathetic, you have to see yourself as other people see you. And the reality that what has been built in this country with redlining, television, right, with the 6 o'clock news, you really converted a people group that, when seeing the same emotions that people get when they see spiders and snakes, they get that. And the only way to empathize is for you to understand and accept that, oh, you thought these were spiders and snakes. And then that you have to say, no, these people are okay. But in order not to be angered, right, you have to say, oh, well, I can understand that you saw them as different from yourself. That's difficult because you don't want the children to be in on that. And it's difficult when you notice that the children already know. So, yeah, I think I'm being transported back to that moment. But we had had a, and this was not a luxury, space. It was a beautiful space, but it's a Cub Scout space. And I think when those, and we were there, the staff, everyone was good. But I guess on Sunday, a new staff came in. And so there were people there that had not been with us all weekend. And there were new parents and new kids. And so when they walked into the calf that they had been going into all weekend, they were told by people that you can't be in here. And when they came out and told me, and after I shared and they understood, I said, y'all want to go eat? They said, no, take us to McDonald's. I remember that because that's like, right? Because everything that we're, kind of fighting and moving and trying to, even talk about healthy food and healthy eating, it was like, no, take us to our place because this is not for us. And in fact, Reb, even though we had an all right time, we knew it wasn't for us. And we're not interested in like taking the time to get over the obstacles. We're not even interested in being accepted. So those are the pieces. And so again, we give up on some of these spaces of beauty. I like to tell people the story of the Buffalo Soldiers and our national parks and the fact that, a lot of these young people, that's how they came here. Like their great grandparents came here as Buffalo Soldiers, tended the parks. But they don't feel at home in the parks. They don't know that it's a part of their legacy, right? They have given that over to whatever other power there is. And so we want to get in here and kind of fight for our young people, but we don't want our young people to have to fight. And so all of that just came up for me as just kind of mentioning it, but it's a sad reality. There's still places for us and there's still places for them.
Well, thank you for just being vulnerable and open about that. And I see there's still so much more work that needs to be done so that all people, especially people of color, can feel safe in nature, because there is a plethora of research that shows how nature is so good for all of us. It helps us reduce our stress, our blood pressure. It helps us just get reconnected to Mother Earth, as we kind of talked about in the beginning. And so this is just part of the ongoing work that we all need to do. I have to continue to work on my own unconscious racial biases and monitor my thoughts, and it's ongoing work, and everyone has to do their share, because that needs to not be happening anymore. Okay, so I really would like to
Please.
ask you about this and then we can go to the jazz. So you're also a fellow in the Atlantic Fellows for Racial Equity based out of Columbia University in New York and the Nelson Mandela Foundation in Johannesburg, South Africa. And I read that your fellowship was slated to visit Johannesburg, South Africa and another American city to compare and analyze the two cities about how marginalized residents see themselves in relation to power. The pandemic intervened, and so you guys had to meet virtually for a while. And then you and your fellows were going to meet in Oxford, England, per
Right.
tradition of this fellowship. And then in 2022, I read all 400 of you traveled to Thailand with the purpose of connecting at the intersection of race and equity. And Thailand is a country that is heavily steeped in Buddhism. And in an article on the Green the Church website, which I highly recommend reading everyone, I read about how you were able to visit Buddhist temples and really gain a deep exposure to this faith. And the author Ruthie Redman wrote, Pastor Carroll sees religion as a powerful motif for what it means to be human. He views the Bible and the insert here, I think Tibetan Book of the Dead, as sacred texts that contain within them psychological, scientific, and cosmic truths that change names depending on the culture, but the lessons remain the same. I wonder if you could elaborate on your exposure to Buddhism in Thailand, being there with your fellowship, and just the idea in general that all religion stems from the same God.
Thank you, thank you. Yeah, well, that's a lot. Yeah, I think so AFRI has been incredible. Atlantic Fellows for Racial Equity is one of, I think, eight or nine separate fellowships. He was part owner of the duty free shops in the airports, and when they sold that massive business, he must have given, like, I don't know, $1 billion or so to this Atlantic Fellows concept, because he wanted people of color to be able to connect globally in order to be in dialogue. And I don't know if that totally got at the question that you asked, but I've been honored and have learned a lot about other people and other structures at a different level. And so to be there at the Buddhist temple, just to be in the space, to be guided and taught, was good for my spirit. There's so much more I have to learn.
Now it's time to listen to some jazz. Due to copyright laws, we cannot play the music on air at this time. I respect copyright laws and the incredible artists who created the jazz we listen to, as without them, we would have no jazz. I will leave links to the songs we listen to so you can pause and listen to the songs along with us. It is my dream to someday grow this podcast to the point where I can eventually host it on a major streaming platform which owns the right to play music, so we can all have the communal experience of listening together. Until then, please bear with me. Okay, well, today we are going to be listening to the work of drummer Max Roach. And Max Roach was one of the most important and influential drummers of the 20th century. And he was also a civil rights activist. He became more politically inclined as the civil rights movement took off. And so I thought he would be a perfect pairing since we're talking about spirituality and
Right.
activism, and you are an activist.
Excellent.
So Max Roach, I'll just give a little bio on him. He was born in Newland, North Carolina in 1924. He grew up in a household where gospel music was very prominent. His mother was a gospel singer. He began drumming in a gospel ensemble at age 10. He studied at the Manhattan School of Music in New York, and he began to play with a lot of the jazz giants of the bebop era, such as Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Thelonious Monk, and Bud Powell. He continued to branch out in the 40s, playing with Benny Carter and Miles Davis, and he very famously worked with Clifford Brown for a number of years. So, in this concert, we're going to hear Max Roach on the drums, Clifford Brown on the trumpet, Teddy Edwards on the tenor sax, Carl Perkins on piano, and George Bledsoe on the bass. So we're going to hear Clifford Brown and the narrator of the concert just for, or Max Roach at the beginning, and then we will hear this song. It is called All God's Chillin' Got Rhythm. All right. Well, Max Roach showing us his virtuosity and Clifford Brown on the trumpet. Dr. Carroll, what was that like for you to hear? What thoughts, feelings, and emotions came up? And what category would you put that in according to the categories of emotional listening?
I think it was definitely a rush. I think I'm wondering if I would have... So when you set the background for us, though, like it told us what time we were in, I thought that was touching in of itself. The notion all God's children got rhythm. I mean, what I felt, right? What I felt was like the word that comes to mind is in invitation. It felt like an invitation. It felt like they were opening it up to all spirits, to everybody to participate. And just the swing was powerful, but it felt jubilant. It felt playful. Yeah. But the backdrop is so intense at the same time, right? Maybe that's just, so those are feelings that those are thoughts I think I had as we start.
I really felt the joy in this song too. And I was just, it was a very, yeah, I just felt like joy radiating in my body. And I was thinking about this concept that having joy for Black people and Black artists, and this was pointed out to me by my social media manager, who is 21, and they are gender non-binary, right. And they are always teaching me new things and expanding my consciousness, that the act of being happy and being in joy in and of itself was an act of resistance against the oppression that was happening at the time. And we hear that this undeniable virtuosity, this joy that is coming through. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, that really is it. And that is one of the reasons why jazz is America's art form, created by Black Americans, is one of the reasons why it's just so incredible in and of itself, the joy and the undeniable greatness that is there that cannot be denied or oppressed no matter what.
Yeah. For me, it's kind of like, it's like that place of calling that I talked about earlier, right? It's like being in that place where you can't sleep, you can't eat. It's being, for me, that was, I was definitely in a zone, right, to be able to pick up on what the divine was putting out. So we see it in other places. I watch a little basketball. I wouldn't say I'm a fan. But I watched Steph Curry get in the zone and just keep hitting those threes, right? Like, he's gone, right? Like, he's in a space, right? He's there. And when you're there, you're doing things that are manifesting, but what you're doing is spiritual, right? So to hear those gentlemen playing, right, 1954, and be standing in that place, and like, they're still like, you know, Strange Fruit is a song, right? People are being lynched, like literally, right, at the same time. But what they're playing, it's coming through them, but they're in this zone where they're able to hear and to filtrate, right, the joy of what is divine, right? It's the John Coltrane stuff. But it's really something that I think, it can be considered a spiritual practice within itself. I think that's all I'm saying. And when you're listening, you're hearing stuff coming through, and you're seeing individuals that are preparing themselves to kind of be a vessel for that. And jazz is always so much in the moment, right? It's not, right? It's like, it's true. And I think, and the truth of that comes through. And then you have to ask yourself the question, like, how can these people be in that place of joy? How can they be instruments that brings that to life? And I think, again, like this notion of activism, I say it's about taking responsibility. And oftentimes we're waiting on someone else. But what has been stirred up in them that they can take the responsibility and actually feel like they can extend the invitation? That's my words. That's kind of how I experienced it. Like it's an invitation, right? But sometimes people don't see themselves empowered enough. They don't have enough in their cup to extend invitation to others. So I think that's a powerful part of what I experienced by listening.
Oh, I love that. And jazz, I really do believe that it comes from source, and just hearing them tapped into that, like from God, the beautiful music flowing through them and the joy in spite of everything else that was going on. I would put this in the category of emotional elevation because it does lift our mood, and emotional galvanization, since, as you're saying, it's very inspiring. It makes us want to go out and do more.
Yeah.
Well, we are now going to move to our song number 2, and we're going to travel forward in time. We're going to go to 1964. And so the piece we're going to hear is from Max Roach's album called We Insist! Freedom Now Sweet. And just to give some historical context on this album, Max Roach in 1960 was working on an album that he intended to be performed in 1963, the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. However, when he was working on this album, inspired by what was happening in the United States in terms of the oppression and Jim Crow laws and the civil rights movement, and also what was happening in South Africa. And he was working with a lyricist, Oscar Brown Jr., to put words to the music that he was writing. And so originally it was going to come out in 1963. However, the Greensboro sit-ins in North Carolina were happening starting February 1st, 1960, and went on to July 25th, 1960. And this was, as everybody knows, the movement that really led to the Woolworth Company department store desegregating all of its restaurants. And this was a huge point in the civil rights movement. And Max Roach decided that because this was going on, he was going to speed up his work, and wanted it recorded in this same year, 1960. So he ended up going ahead without the consent of the lyricist. And we are going to hear a piece called Triptych, Prayer, Protest/Peace. And he says Triptych is the third, and it's the middle track of this album. And this piece is supposed to link, and Abby Lincoln, who was his wife at the time, is the vocalist. And she is going to embody these three pieces, prayer, protest, and speech, and peace. And we're going to hear her scream in the middle of this piece. And her rage is expressing the sentiment of what people were feeling at the time. And then Max Roach said at the end, he said to Abby Lincoln, peace, he said, is the feeling of relaxed exhaustion after you've done everything you can to assert yourself. You can now rest because you've worked to be free. So this is kind of his artistic intent going in to listen to this. So this was recorded in 1960. It was came out to kind of mixed reception by the critics, and it was not performed in the United States. However, it was recorded as a concert in Belgium in 1964. And so we're going to, and there's actually a live recording of it. We're going to watch that. We're going to watch the introduction. We're going to see the narrator speak in Belgian or in Flemish, I believe, and he's going to introduce the piece. And then we'll go to the middle where we start seeing Abby Lincoln sing this piece called Triptych. So we just heard Max Roach and Abby Lincoln in We Insist Freedom Now Suite. So Dr. Carol, what was it like to hear this really incredible piece of music?
I think for me, three pieces came up. I think emotional justice, for one, just the ability to be in a place to feel that art and that music, and in the midst of it, melodies, but also in the midst of it, rage. And I think that that's, you know, emotional justice, that somehow that helps to bring balance to what people are feeling on the inside that they cannot articulate. I think that music has the ability to do that. I also felt like the ability to set the tone, right? Tone setting, to use this music and for people to attempt to understand what is happening in the United States of America, right? After a World War II, right? After there is a narrative of this is a place of justice and this is the place that's fighting for the right, that still has these deep-seated issues of racism, of othering, but for the music to help set the tone of what the world can be. Those are some of the kind of thoughts and feelings that I had as I listened and thought about it.
I really love that, and that makes a lot of sense. It makes me think about when I was reading about Brown versus Board of Education, I learned that the State Department actually filed an amicus curiae with that, which is a friend of the court brief. Mm-hmm. And they argued that by upholding segregation, it continued to give communist propaganda against, you know, the United States being very hypocritical that we're preaching justice and freedom, and yet to our own citizens, that's absolutely was not shown to, you know, blacks for generations, hundreds of years. Right. I thought that was an interesting piece that was put in there as well. This piece of music was so intense and it was so beautiful. The way that Max Roach sort of conceptualized it, and just to see Abby Lincoln go through all of the stages of her emotions of prayer, then let her rage out, and then the peace part. Mm. The whole thing was so beautiful, and it was also wonderful that it could be presented as a concert in Europe. And Europe has been a bastion of, in a way, for jazz artists, many of whom toured over there and lived because the conditions were better. It wasn't totally racist free. It was still racist, but it was less racist in the United States. So I do appreciate that. And it is sad that this concert couldn't have been performed in the United States, which is what Max Roach intended, that it be performed in 1963 on the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. I would also put it in the category of emotional social justice and also emotional galvanization, because it is very inspiring. There is a call to action in it too, of like, he's making art and making a statement. And yet we knew that, you know, there was so much more to be done after this. Very powerful. Well, this piece at the time came out to kind of lukewarm critical feedback. Some critics said that obviously Max Roach was not going along the vein of Dr. Martin Luther King, his philosophy of ahimsa and nonviolence, because of the rage that was expressed. Right. However, modern critics and everybody now regards this piece as one of the most iconic pieces, and just a genius work of art that Max Roach did. So obviously history has changed in terms of how we see this piece, which is really wonderful.
Generated. Yes, indeed.
Well, we are just almost at the end of our time today, Dr. Carol. And I wonder if you could just tell the audience about where they could find you. You have a website, and how they could also support the work that Green the Church is doing in terms of joining, being a member, and just anything in that vein.
Yes, indeed. You can find us at www.greenthechurch.org. greenthechurch.org. Would love to have you come and be a part of our climate revival.
Well, there you have it, everybody. Check out Green the Church, the website. There is so much information. And it was such a pleasure to be able to research and prepare for this interview because there is so much extensive information on your site and also written about you. So that was really, really wonderful. So finally, just before we sign off, I wanted to just share I'll screen share really quick, a portrait of Max Roach. This is an abstract interpretation that Jean-Michel Basquiat did. And this is acrylic and crayon.
Wow.
And this is his take on Max Roach. And I just thought this was another element of beauty that we could add, one artist interpreting another artist. And finally, I ask all guests on this podcast when we wrap up that you can dedicate this to a cause in the world or a loved one, just whatever is on your heart. It's kind of a way of using all the goodness that came out of today and passing it forward. And so I wanted to just ask you, what would you like your dedication of merit for everything you did today to be to?
Wow. I would dedicate this to the new marriage of my niece, Crystal, Carol, to Brother Michael, and to their children and to all that life has in store for them.
So it's just truly been an honor and a real pleasure, Reverend Dr. Carroll, to have you here today. And I just thank you so much. Thank you for listening, reflecting, and being present with us today. Please leave us a review and comment as we love feedback and aim to continuously improve and innovate, embodying the spirit of jazz itself. Jazz Therapy is edited and produced by Patricio Garcia. Sage Salmon is our social media coordinator. To connect with us, find us on Instagram and TikTok. Our email is info@jazztherapy.com. Check back next week for our next episode. May Jazz Therapy soothe your soul.